Art by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Enjoy free performances in Krannert Center's lobby, an afterglow with U of I jazz faculty on March 5th, a noontime interval with Laura Fuentes y Calicanto on March 30th, and a final afterglow on April 9th. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking back over the last several decades and looking at how environmental law developed in this country. If you look back to the 1970s, what you will find is that at that time, when the EPA was young and environmental law was young, there were a lot of people that were afraid that environmental legislation that at the time was new either would end up being gutted in the future or simply wouldn't be enforced. And it's fortunately enough turned out that neither of those has been the case. However, all the way along over the last three decades, there have been efforts to weaken the environmental laws that exist. So the question we'll sort of take up this morning is to try to talk a little bit about how it is, in fact, we ended up with the environmental laws we have, whether they are strong enough to last, what we kind of can expect in the future. And our guest for the program is Richard Lazarus. He teaches environmental law and natural resources law at Georgetown Law School. He previously worked for the U.S. Justice Department in both the Environmental and Natural Resources Division and also the Solicitor General's Office, where he was assistant to the Solicitor General. He has represented the United States, also state and local governments and environmental groups, in the U.S. Supreme Court in approximately 37 cases, and is author of a book that's recently published. The title of the book is The Making of Environmental Law. And it's published by the University of Chicago Press, came out last year. And the idea is, as we hope to do on this program, to take a little bit of a stroll back over the last several decades to look at how it is we ended up with the laws that we have and where things are headed. So questions are certainly welcome here on the program. The one thing that we ask people who call in to do is just to try to be brief so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep our program moving along. Of course, anybody's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Lazarus, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Delighted to be here.
Thanks for talking with us. You begin this book with a little story here about the fact, and I did want to mention the fact that you got your undergraduate degrees here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, back in the 70s.
And
that's
right.
That you have degrees in both chemistry and economics. And your idea apparently at the time was that once you finished your undergraduate degrees here, that you would go to law school and that you would become an environmental lawyer.
Absolutely right. No, my plan back when I started the University of Illinois in the early 1970s, this was in the fall of 1971, was ultimately to study environmental law in law school and to become an environmental law professor, actually. And the reason I studied in chemistry and economics was I sat down at the University of Illinois at the course catalog and tried to figure out what would be the best possible major if I wanted to go into environmental law. And I remember at the time, environmental law was so new back then, when people would ask me, my classmates at Illinois would ask me, why are you getting a degree in chemistry and a degree in economics? And I would say, well, it's a pre-environmental law program. It was not at all unusual for someone to say to me, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't even know what I meant by the term environmental law back in the fall of 1971. And in retrospect, that's not surprising. There wasn't a lot of law back then.
Well, here we're talking about the time when these kinds of ideas were relatively young. After all, in 1970, that was when we had the first Earth Day, and then also, I believe, in 1970, that's when the EPA, the federal EPA, was created. In 1970, the first major kind of environmental legislation, Clean Air Act, was passed. So all of this was at the time, really very new.
Absolutely. I mean, before 1970, you had no EPA, you had no Clean Air Act, as you said, you had no Clean Water Act, you know, had no federal hazardous waste law, and there really were hardly any state analogs either. It was law which was fairly non-existent in the pollution control area. There was a rich history of natural resources law and natural resource management, but in the pollution control area, there really was very little except the common law.
The other, I guess I want to round out the story because I kind of like it. And you tell in the book the fact that here you were an undergraduate and at part time to make some money, you were working as a bartender.
Right, at the Ramada Inn.
And that one night you were talking with somebody who was there in the bar, and then you find out that he was somebody who worked. He was a corporate officer for a manufacturing company here in Champaign-Urbana. And so you were talking with this guy, and you said, well, I'm going to go on and be an environmental lawyer. And the man urged you to find some other line of work, some other career aspirations, because he said, oh, environmental law, just a fad. It'll pass.
Yeah.
It's a great story. And obviously you believed that, in fact, it wouldn't. And it turned out that you were right and he was not.
Yeah, it turned out I was right. But as I point out actually in the introduction to the book, it took me a while to realize that there was actually a lot more force to his intuition than I assumed at the time. At the time, I just sort of dismissed his comments as someone who didn't understand what was happening. But the fact is, when one actually starts to study environmental law, it's amazing that it happened. Any political scientist, any scholar of government would have told anyone in the 1960s that these kinds of laws would never pass, that you would never get Congress, you would never get the states to pass the kind of unbelievably sweeping and ambitious laws that were enacted in the 1970s. It just would never politically happen.
Well, just I have a caller here, and I try not to make people wait forever. So in a couple of minutes here, we'll get to the caller. But now that you have said that, something we can talk about in some depth maybe, but give me a thumbnail sketch. Give me your top two, three factors. What came together to make it possible for environmental laws to be passed in the face of opposition and forces that would seem to have worked, been set up against it?
Yeah. Well, let me give you a sense of what the main obstacle is. Mm-hmm. And the main obstacle that environmental law faces is as follows. And that is, by the laws of nature, what happens in the ecosystem is whenever there's any kind of pollution, the pollution activity tends to occur in one place, and the consequences tend to occur at a different place, quite far away. And similarly, you have pollution that occurs at one time, but then the consequences are often realized at a different time. So there's a dramatic spreading out of cause and effect. In environmental law, what it does is it regulates people and activities at one place and at one time for the benefit of people at another place and another time. It's very hard to pass that kind of law, because you're basically imposing costs on some people for the benefit of others. And it's very hard to get that kind of law through any kind of political system, because you're asking people to impose costs on themselves for the benefit of others in distant places and distant times. And what happened really quite amazingly in the 1960s is that people were able to bridge that spatial and temporal divide, and they began to realize how much they had at stake. And there were several things, I think, that led to that. The first was there were writers like Rachel Carson. There were writers like Barry Commoner. There were a series of writers who captured the imagination, sometimes the fear of the American public. And when people began to realize that the miracles of modern chemistry, which were widely trumpeted and heralded in the 1950s and 1960s, also had hidden dangers. Chemicals which once were perceived exclusively as ridding of disease and increasing productivity were now projected to actually portend a possible silent spring, in Rachel Carson's words. The atom, which was viewed as a potential source of boundless energy, was instead being promoted as possibly capable of destroying life as we knew it. Strontium-90 produced from nuclear reactions could pose hazards for generations. One of the things that I thought was one of the most interesting, though, if you look back to the 1960s and try to understand the dynamic of what caused people to sort of move towards the environmental movement, was space exploration. Space exploration was something which I think everyone at the time thought would show how far technology could reach and how far we could open up our horizons in the future. But the impact on the American public of seeing those first images from outer space of Earth was exactly the opposite. It made the Earth seem really fragile. It made it seem very confined and very vulnerable. and it emphasized our sort of limits rather than our potential. The last thing, I think, which undoubtedly played a major role in the 1960s, leading to this explosion of statutes in the 1970s, was we had a nation, as many of us remember well, certainly I remember being on campus at the time in the 1960s, growing up in Urbana, Illinois, we had a nation torn apart. It was a nation torn apart by war. It was a nation torn apart by race. It was a nation torn apart by a series of really profoundly tragic and sad political assassinations. And what environmentalism at the time and Earth Day in the spring of 1970 offered was a possibility of hope. It was a possibility of consensus, a possibility of thinking about the future. It offered the possibility of building bridges between generations, when at the time the term of art was a generation gap rather than a bridge between generations. And environmental law provided a political opportunity for people to come together and try to reach beyond the negative and to find something positive to address and to reach for a better future.
Hmm. Well, we have a caller we'd get right to, and for anybody who has just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Richard Lazarus. He's professor of law at Georgetown University, and his special area of interest is environmental and natural resources law. He's the author of a book that looks at the history of environmental law over the last several decades, and that was just published last fall by the University of Chicago Press, and that is The Making of Environmental Law. So if you're interested in reading on that subject, you can seek out the book. He's joining us this morning by phone, and we'd be very happy to have questions. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana here where we are. There's also a toll-free line, so no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here ready to go in Champaign, I believe. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, actually a question a little bit more towards the future of environmental law. It seems that one of the trends that's moving forward has a lot to do with making a higher degree of accountability for the costs in environmental controls. You have things like Measure 37 in Oregon, where if a person is deprived of something because of development restrictions or, and there are some other examples of environmental regulations imposing costs, then somebody has to reimburse them for it. And it seems to be a way of sort of undercutting these generally beneficial regulations. I think my leanings are a little clear in this, but where do you think this is going? I mean, we passed a lot of sort of very sweeping laws that imposed costs on people for benefits of other people. And the argument to counter that and to essentially get rid of these is that the direct costs are unfair. So as a lawyer and a historian, where do you think that's going to go in the future? And I'll just listen here.
The caller is absolutely right. Ever since these statutes were passed in the 1970s, there has been sort of a drumbeat of a counter-movement, basically, to try to slow their implementation. And a lot of that has been done to try to suggest that the costs of the laws are too high. And that the government should reimburse people for any of the costs that they have to suffer. Until recently, most of those reform movements, some of them have been in the context of regulatory takings claims based on the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, claiming that the statutes are unconstitutional, have failed. And then there have been several measures like Measure 37 in Oregon, which purports basically to require that government pay property owners for every sort of lost economic value they suffer as a result of the implementation of environmental statute. Those laws, I think in the long run, they're unlikely to go very far, because I think once people realize the implications of these kinds of statutes, it sounds really fair on its face to say that, well, if the government does something which has an adverse economic effect, then the government has to pay for it. The problem with it is that if the government pays for every cost, it will very quickly shut down, because the government has no ability to turn around and recapture the benefit. I mean, every time the government does anything, for instance, the environmental statute, which has a very significant economic benefit for somebody, the government has no ability, nor should it, turn around and say to somebody, well, since we've done something which has created a benefit, we're now going to tax you to recapture that benefit. And unless the government can do that, which it can't, it can't be expected to pay all the costs either. Instead, the fair approach here is you have to assume, and I think it's a fair assumption, that these statutes basically balance the benefits and burdens of having a society at a certain level of environmental protection. And sometimes people pay costs, and other times they enjoy benefits. In the long term, everyone enjoys the benefits of these statutes. The statutes back several decades ago were viewed, I think, exclusively as sort of disruptive economic expectations, and people viewed them just as having costs. These days, I think the awareness is much greater that we all, in the long term, benefit from these statutes, that there's basically a billion-dollar pollution control industry in the United States, that people's land values now very much depend upon environmental protection, that industry enjoys the use of cleaner water and cleaner air for its workers. So I think it's a mistake, and I think Oregon Measure 37 is a classic example of a mistake, to say that government's got to pay for every isolated cost, because very quickly, if government has to do that, it will not enact these laws at all, and we will all be paying much greater costs in the long term.
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We have someone else here again in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question, a tactic, perhaps. Has anyone ever thought of charging the person who is receiving the payment for loss the benefit? Because they also benefit. And it seems to me their benefit from whatever the action is might even be greater than their loss.
I think that there has been discussion of if you're going to have laws which say that the government has to pay the cost, then in fact you should make sure that the government is also recouping the benefit.
Yes, well, I'm thinking of the person in particular who claims the loss.
Yeah, no, and I think instead, I think the government has decided that, and the courts have generally decided, most legislatures have decided, that it's better just simply not to have the government into the business of trying to make all those kinds of specific calculations.
Well, I agree, but I was trying to be Machiavellian.
Right. But it's certainly true that what people often say is that these statutes are often referred to as taking,
mm-hmm.
But the fact is these statutes are really also givings.
Absolutely.
Well, and that you shouldn't just look at the taking part of the equation. One should look to the giving part of the equation as well. And I think that's one of the best defenses you have of the statutes.
Well, best wishes, and I hope you have great success.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Once again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Richard Lazarus, he's professor of law at Georgetown University. And we're talking about environmental law and how it is we ended up with the laws that we have, how well they have served us, and your questions, comments are welcome. I'm going back to talk a little bit about the atmosphere at the time in around 1970. You talked about some of the forces that came into play. There were a lot of people that, of course, were very articulate, powerful advocates of the idea of environmental protection. But it seems almost a little bit ironic that the man who is really, you know, in large part responsible for the fact that we have the EPA and that we have NOAA, the Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, then we have the Clean Air Act, is Richard Nixon, a guy that you don't particularly think of as being a great progressive. How is it that this happened in the Nixon administration?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, Richard Nixon's involvement here. You know, basically Richard Nixon, you know, was elected president in November 68, inaugurated in 1969. And President Nixon pretty quickly identified environmental protection as what he thought would be a very good political issue. And he identified as his chief rival going into the 1972 presidential season, several years after then, Ed Muskie from Maine. And Ed Muskie at the time was chair of the Senate Committee on Environment Public Works. And so what one had in the late 1960s, early 1970s, was literally a competition between Richard Nixon and Ed Muskie for who could sort of capture what they thought looked like a very big potential pro-environmental vote. And the two of them during 1970 actually kept competing for who could propose a tougher Clean Air Act. One would do it, the other would respond, and you ended up with a law which was incredibly tough, as each one basically thought that they were going to become the premier environmentalist. What's interesting is that Richard Nixon was a really thoughtful, did a lot of very serious, significant things in favor of environmental protection in 1969, in 1970, including a quite thoughtful message the first and last ever presidential environmental message in February 1970, a very thoughtful speech by Richard Nixon. But after the congressional elections of 1970, within about a year or so of then, Richard Nixon pretty quickly changed his mind. If you go back to the Nixon papers, the Ehrlichman and Haldeman as chief advisors, and you see the notes that were taken during the meeting, Richard Nixon pretty quickly decided this was not a good political issue, that he was getting nothing for it. And he told his advisors, he said basically in 1972 or 73, he said, it's time for us to get off the environmental kick. We've been, quote, sucked in too much by the environmentalists. And in a private meeting with some auto industry leaders, he said, environmentalists are enemies of the system. We want people to go back and live like a bunch of animals. So Richard Nixon did a switch. He decided it wasn't a good political issue, and he vetoed the Clean Water Act of 1972. He impounded the funds, and of course, the end of his second term was obviously engulfed by Watergate. But Nixon did a pretty interesting about faith. On the other hand, absolutely right. In those early years, in sort of jump-starting the whole federal statutory program, Richard Nixon played an absolutely key central role.
Let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Urbana now on line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was thinking about the economics and so forth, how narrow people think, narrowly people think, and I'm thinking particularly of something like the problem in the north, Alaskan wildlife area and so forth, and oil, and how people are so eager to make gasoline less expensive and so forth, and how short-sighted that is when you think of how expensive everything's going to be if all that damage is done and we have higher water and so forth.
Yeah, the ANWR, Alaska National Wildlife Refuge controversy right now is sort of a classic example of the kind of spatial problems which environmental law presents, because it's very seems very easy to simply take all the oil and petroleum out of that area for our enjoyment down here, because people never actually have to see what's going up in Alaska. But underlying, I think, the caller's concern is a very profound threat right now to environmental statutes, and I think one of the more significant ones the nation has faced in decades. And that is currently consumption patterns in the United States, which is really what's driving the potential untapping of the petroleum reserves in Alaska. Consumption patterns in the United States are basically going off the roof right now, along several dimensions.
Well, and another example I think of is a matter of the clean air and so forth. We have all this expensive medical care, and yet if we don't protect the areas that keep us healthy,
right,
like the air and so forth, and the water and so forth, then the medical costs will go even farther through the roof, right?
That's right. There's no question that we spend too much at the back end and not enough at the front end. I mean, we've had dramatic success, for instance, in bringing down a lot of the classic air pollutants during the past several decades. I mean, they've gone down basically by about, our six principal pollutants have gone down by 25% in the last 30 years, while our gross domestic product has gone up by 160%. But with that said, it's only recently we've begun to regulate particulate, really small particulate pollution, which has a huge impact on hospital admissions, on people's daily lives and ability to work, and especially on asthmatics and young children and the elderly. And as you point out, the cost to society, the medical cost to society of taking care of these individuals is dramatically smaller than the control cost. The EPA recently in the 1990s did a cost-benefit analysis of the cost saved as a result of these reductions in pollution, and it's overwhelmingly in favor of control of these pollutants.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, other calls are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It was, since the subject of ANWR has come up, it may be a bit of a side issue, but I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about it. And what strikes me is the remarkable persistence of this as an issue, that it is true that we need oil and the demand is very high and there is oil there. And the argument on the one side has made that we should go and exploit that resource. On the other side, environmentalists for a long time have been saying that it's one of the few pristine areas that there are left, and make the argument that to develop that resource would be expensive, it would take a lot of time, and at our present rates of consumption, it would be used up pretty quickly.
Right.
Just recently, in fact, I think I read an article saying that now even the oil companies are saying, we don't care.
Right.
Even if you told us we could go, we're not going to do it. And yet now for decades, this issue will not die, which in my mind suggests that the symbolic significance may be far and away more than the significance of the oil that's there.
You're absolutely right. And candidly, both sides will tell you that. The environmentalists will tell you that this is a sort of major symbolic battle, and they think very significant one. Because they view it as if they lose ANWR, then a lot of other things will fall. And for the oil industry, it really is not something which holds extraordinary promise for them. This is something which has been captured very much by the politicians, and it's a very important symbolic battle. But it's not one of the more important ones as a practical matter.
Hmm. Is it? Do you think it's likely that those people who are arguing that the resource should be exploited will they give up? Will they abandon that, or are they just going to keep on?
No, they'll keep on, and they're likely to win. I think the best guess right now is that legislation will go through. It will go through probably this spring, and if not this summer. And the way that it will go through is also, I think, somewhat significant in terms of thinking about how environmental law has changed over the past 30 years. If you go back to the role of Congress and the environmental statutes in the 1970s, Congress passed these very, very dynamic and sweeping, comprehensive laws dealing with, you know, air, water, endangered species, pesticides, solid and hazardous waste, sort of one very sweeping law after another. And they were done in a legislative process which was quite classic. It would be considered by a certain committee that was expert in the area. That committee would issue a report after holding, you know, months and months of hearings. It would go to Congress, pass both chambers, maybe have a conference committee, and then finally be signed by the president. Congress doesn't pass laws this way anymore. And those old statutes, by the way, were always passed by a very, very wide margins with bipartisan support. If you fast forward now, Congress doesn't pass any environmental laws anymore that way. They certainly don't pass anything with bipartisan support. And the way that the ANWR, Alaska legislation, is likely to pass is indicative. Because what will happen is it will not probably pass as part of a straight-up statute. It's probably going to be buried in about a 3,000-page omnibus budget bill, where Congress has to pass something in order to keep the federal government open. Mm-hmm. And then they have to they throw in all kinds of little miscellaneous riders, sometimes which people don't even know exist at the time that they pass and vote on the bill. And my guess is that's where we're finally going to see the Alaska legislation slip through Congress. It'll be put in part of a 2,000 or 3,000-page omnibus bill. As a practical matter, people won't be able to vote against the bill because they can't afford to have the government shut down. And it will finally squeak through. But that's a far cry from the kind of really bipartisan, thoughtful, deliberative process, I think, that marked a lot of congressional legislation in the 1970s and 1980s with bipartisan support. Hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Richard Lazarus. He has been involved in shaping the development of modern environmental law in a lot of ways, at least he's been involved in many of the important issues. He's been litigator for the Department of Justice, Environment and Natural Resources Division, an assistant to the Solicitor General, also a member of the advisory boards of the EPA, the World Wildlife Fund, the Environmental Defense Fund. He is professor of law at Georgetown University and teaches there environmental law and natural resources. Resources Law. If you're interested in reading some on the subject that we are here talking about, you can look for his book, The Making of Environmental Law, was published last fall by the University of Chicago Press, and indeed looks at how it is that environmental law has developed over the last several decades, basically going back to the 1970s and taking it up to the present. Questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have several callers here ready to go. First in line is someone listening in Savoy nearby, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how you doing?
Fine.
Yeah, hey, this is an interesting subject. You know, we've worked on a number of projects. One of them recently is the automotive industry, and they, to meet the CAFE standards, they say that they need magnesium. And there's only two domestic suppliers of magnesium in North America. And the reason that a new plant hasn't been built is it's so expensive to build these things.
Right.
That, to meet all the standards, and in particular, one of them that's very difficult to meet is people split hairs over how many nanograms a year of dioxin comes out of these things. And people just throw their hands up in the air and they say, well, hey, we're not going to build them. And I'll tell you where they end up getting built. They end up getting built in China.
Right.
And whenever you look at the process that they use to make magnesium that the automobile industry uses to meet the CAFE standards, you know, it would make even a staunch environmentalist blanch. Why are we doing this?
Right.
Now, I understand, you know, we've worked in environmental law for many, many years in this country, and we've helped many, many companies. And I'm here to say it. There's no major pollution going on in this country with an upfront company. And it's been that way for a good 20 or 30 years. But I'll tell you, the laws have reached the point now where people are—they're not satisfied with the old standards. They keep increasing them, increasing them, increasing them. And what happens is you end up sending something. You end up creating a disaster in China, India, and Lord knows where else. Now, you know that's got to stop because we need these industries and the jobs here in the United States. And it just seems like that has to be taken into account, and you know, and I wonder when it's going to start.
The caller has made, I think, two extremely important points. The first is that no question that one reason why the United States has enjoyed the success it has, in other words, the ability to bring down so significantly the amount of pollution domestically, is that we have exported a lot of it. That we have exported a lot of the polluting industries to other countries. And that allows us, to some extent, to have our cake and eat it, too, in terms of consumption. It doesn't allow us necessarily to have our cake and eat it, too, in terms of employment. But there's no question that it's not a complete answer to simply export these very dirty polluting facilities to other parts of the world, which is why international environmental law now becomes so important to level the playing field. The other point that the caller makes, which I think is equally important, is that one mistake the statutes do tend to do, and they need reform, is they tend to focus too much on just a few sort of most obvious sources of pollution, the most sort of large facilities. And you can only squeeze so much blood out of them.
Yeah, that you can only go so far.
And what happens is there are a lot of sources which are really exempted. There are a lot of different industries which have managed over the years to get one loophole after another. And so what the statutes and regulations do is they keep coming back over and over again to the same players. And that's simply not fair, nor is it economically efficient because you could get much. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. And I think that there's no question the statutes need to be redirected. And in part, they need to regulate, they need to influence demand instead of just going after the manufacturers. A lot of the source of the problem right now are people's consumption patterns and how much they drive and how much they unnecessarily expend resources.
Yeah, you know, everyone focuses, you know, like we've been involved in, you know, like on these light metal projects for, it's mainly automotive. But I'll tell you another thing that you could do to, you know, improve the situation in the automobile and really what you call the durable goods industry is to make stuff more reliable.
Right.
And make sure that it always works and that it's always, and, you know, I think that that's swept aside too.
Yeah, you know, no. If you look at consumption patterns right now, people used to keep their electronic goods an average of about 12 years. They now throw things out just every couple of years. I mean, there's no question that there's a lot more personal consumption waste going on than is necessary.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I've got several other people. I hope you forgive me if I go on and want to get some others. And also, just real quick, though, to raise another question that I think he does. And it may be that this is more of a question for an economist, but I expect that you might well have something to say about it. And that is, so often when we talk about environmental protection, there are people who would say, okay, you got a choice. You want your clean environment, fine, but you cannot have a clean environment and a vibrant economy both. You must choose.
And I think the short answer to that is that we've proven just the opposite in the United States during the past 30 years. There, everyone, not everyone, but many prominent people said just that in the 1970s, that you basically, if you had these kinds of strong environment protection laws, it would lead to economic ruin. And in fact, we have an economy and a nation which is stronger than it's ever been before. And we've averted the kinds of disasters that have occurred in other nations. And right now we have much greater awareness that actually our economy is often dependent upon these laws. It doesn't exist despite them. It exists because of them. The tourism industry in the United States, the fishing industry in the United States, the silicon chip industry in the United States, which very much depends upon, you know, clean water to be used. I think we're much better aware that that protection of the environment actually helps our economy. It doesn't destroy it.
We have about 15 minutes left. The lines are full, so we'll get right on to callers again. Just one more time, I want to introduce our guest, Richard Lazarus. He's professor of law at Georgetown University, where he teaches environmental and natural resources law. 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller up is in Champaign County and line two. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I wanted to get to something else later, but I'm provoked to be reminded of Larry Summers' faux pas when he was at the World Bank. He issued this memo that said polluting industries should be done in third world countries because people's life expectancies were lower there. Real obnoxious thing to suggest. But and the other point on that is that there's a circle of poison too. Even though the most polluting part of the production process is done somewhere else, the stuff gets shipped here, and there's a lot of questions about some of the stuff that gets shipped into this country and how it's transformed. But what I wanted to get to was the business about emissions trading, et cetera,
right,
and how that evolved. It seems to me that the Kyoto Accords were tailored so that the U.S. would be interested in them, that the theorists of emissions tradings came from the U.S., and it was patterned on the mercury standard trading of power plants here. And it's kind of ironic that now the U.S., even though it was sort of tailored to the U.S. Purposes, finds other reasons to object to it, mainly, again, lesser developed countries' involvement in it. But on the just to bring it really right up to date, I guess last night the U.S. Torpedoed a mercury regulation that would be sort of some kind of worldwide. I didn't get all the details on that. I'm sure you know them. But it's kind of ironic that this is going back to the earlier idea of regulating by a penalty, in a sense. And I think whatever you can argue one way or another about the whole efficacy of it, but it seems to me that mercury is such a devastating pollution, so long lasting that if there's one thing that we should be able to agree on to have a absolutely no standard to, it would be that. So I'd like to hear your response to that, and I'll just hang up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, the caller is quite well versed on the
role of tradable emission policy in Kyoto, and he's absolutely correct that the tradable emission aspect of the Kyoto Treaty was very much tailored towards the United States. The United States played a major role in the fashioning of that part of the treaty. It was built upon the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, and something which had fairly widespread support at the time from both people on the Republican side of the aisle and people on the Democratic side of the aisle. And it was a major blow to that treaty when the United States turned around in March of 2001 and basically indicated that it would no longer go along with that treaty. The mercury issue, which the caller identified, is a really interesting one. It's a very interesting one domestically as well as internationally, because it actually is an example of the kind of pollutant which probably does not lend itself so readily to a tradable emission policy. The way a tradable emission policy works in environmental law is it says, all right, we want to try to figure out how to get to the right level of mercury emissions. And the way we're going to do it is not tell each individual source how much to put out. Instead, we're going to say, well, there can be a total of 100 units of this put out. And then we're going to basically let the different sources decide for themselves by buying and selling rights to those 100 units, which one's going to put it out and which one instead is going to have to reduce their emissions. But the premise of a tradable emission policy is that we don't care which one of the sources put out the pollutant. We don't care whether it's, for instance, in the acid rain area, we don't care whether it's a power plant in Illinois or a power plant in Indiana or a power plant in Kentucky. As long as the total sum emissions from all of those plants together is not over 100 units, we don't care which one does it. We'll let them fight it out and buy and sell pollution rights between them. That works for certain kinds of pollutants. It works for climate change pollutants. It works for carbon dioxide emissions. It works for sulfur emissions. It doesn't work so readily for mercury emissions for reasons intimated by the caller, because mercury, it does make a difference which facility it comes out of. Because mercury tends, it's a heavy metal, it tends to basically create concentrated hot spots. We're not indifferent to whether it comes from one facility or another. We tend to care a lot about it. So it doesn't lend itself readily to a tradable emissions approach.
All right, let's go to the next caller in line. That's line 3 and Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I would like to hear your guest comment on asbestos in the environment and whether or not there's laws protecting the general public. And two situations come to mind for me. One is, I think I've read that brake linings continue to contain asbestos, so the general public would be exposed to the brake dust as well as people who would be changing brakes in shops. And then the second instance is, at 9/11, when the trade towers went down, it's my understanding that that dust cloud had a significant percentage of asbestos fibers in it, and so it appears a lot of people were exposed to asbestos. So, in general, I'd like the speaker to comment on the asbestos issue and the laws related to it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, can you do that?
Yeah. The caller is actually identified a sort of the one of the main Achilles heels of environmental law, an area which the United States has really accomplished far, far less than it has in other areas. What the environmental statutes tend to regulate very well and very comprehensively is the outdoor environment, what happens in what's referred to as the ambient air and the ambient water. By contrast, the statutes really pay very little attention to what happens indoors. In terms of construction materials, in terms of indoor air pollution, and the like. So while we have very, very tough controls on the outdoor environment, we have relatively weak controls in terms of hazards and safety in the workplace. And as a result, asbestos is a classic example of something which poses very serious health hazards in the indoor environment. But it's not regulated at all. The Clean Air Act doesn't apply indoors. It just applies outdoors. So in the World Trade Center, it comes down, you have an indoor problem, which is basically converted into an outdoor problem, but it was never regulated in the first instance by the federal state. There's very little regulation of the indoor environment. To the extent that Congress at one point
really did try to regulate asbestos in a more comprehensive fashion, and that was under a statute called the Toxic Substance Control Act. Basically, EPA's efforts, it was one of the few efforts to go indoor, was basically dismissed. They lost a very significant court case involving asbestos a couple decades ago, because that was a statute which required EPA more than the others to consider both the costs and the benefits. And EPA ended up being so mired by judicial review of its efforts to do so that we've had very little regulation of indoor pollutants and asbestos in particular.
All right, let's go to Chicago next, line four. Hello.
As a footnote to something you started the program with, I was a bartender back in the 60s, and one of the customers that came in regularly for their lunch was a group of oil executives.
Right.
And part of the little chit-chat and conversation that was bring up once in a while was, hey, where are we going to dump this oil? You know, whatever waste and other products they had, no concern about the processing or safeguards and so forth, but where are we going to dump it? And that seemed to be their song for quite a while. But then on a global level, we have the recent awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to the wonderful spokeslady from Africa who pointed out the very stream upon which she and all the natives were living and raised and nurtured and irrigating their crops has now so been spoiled due to contamination from various pollution standards that were lacking. And so we have the thing, like I say, from way, way back right up until today, and we're still talking about getting peace and harmony with the environment ought to really be so important. And as you stated way back earlier about the space program, noticing the fragile nature of the Earth as an oasis in the universe, as I took it to be, is something that has been lost upon people. And we have to really recognize the fragile nature of the environment more so than has been spoken about. Look at the recent environmental laws that have been developed as a result of smoking. People
right.
smoked nonchalantly, and now we find out that secondhand smoke is a hazard and so on. So we really have to have more publicity on it, and I applaud you for all the things you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I think the caller also reinforces my view always that people need to watch what they say to their bartenders.
It'll come back to haunt you.
We listen more carefully than they think. The caller's point about the oil executives back in 1969 I think also provides an opportunity to comment on another very significant development in environmental law during the past several decades. And that is, I think, that for many companies, a lot of corporate officers' attitudes towards the environment and towards environmental pollution have dramatically changed as a result of these laws. These laws have been in place now for several decades, and I think people who sort of assumed that they could just do things like that, just dump the oil somewhere, it's really more of the renegade that does something like that today. Very few of the major corporation responsible officers would do that. And partly that's because the statutes have not just a significant civil side, they have a significant criminal side. And when you have very tough laws, as they are, and these are very expensive laws for compliance, one necessary effect is it makes it very profitable to commit a crime. Because if you're going to save a lot of money by not complying with the statute, that means that there's a huge incentive, at least, to commit a crime. And in the short term, what the statutes had in the 1970s and 1980s was the indirect effect of promoting crime. And you had actually organized crime getting involved in the pollution control business because they could make a buck. They could make it in drugs. They could make it lots of it. In gambling, they could make it in pollution mismanagement as well. And as a result of the 1980s and 1990s, the federal government and now the state and local governments dramatically upped the ante in terms of criminal enforcement of the environmental statutes. And they went after corporations, officers, organized crime officials who were starting to basically flout these statutes in order to save millions of dollars. Because you need to have a very, very rigorous criminal enforcement arm to environmental law. And we've enjoyed that now for a decade plus. And I think that has had a major effect on people's attitudes. There's nothing that brings the lesson home in a more focused fashion than actually saying, if you do this, this is like murder.
This is the kind of thing which receives the society's greatest condemnation, to such an extent they're willing to take away your liberty. And the moral stigma associated with the criminal enforcement of our federal environmental statutes, I think, has done a great service into making people realize the importance of these statutes and what the stakes are if you actually take something and dump it in a waterway, and the kind of damage you do to people, the damage you do to the natural ecosystem.
Well, you know, I think probably at about this point we're going to have to stop, and I must apologize. We have a couple of callers we're not going to be able to take, but we have used our time. If there are people who are listening who are interested in reading more on the subject, however, looking at how environmental law has developed over the last few decades, they should look for this book that we mentioned a couple of times by our guest. It's titled The Making of Environmental Law. It was published by the University of Chicago Press last fall. I'm sure it could be found in the library or the bookstore. Our guests in this hour of Focus 580, Richard Lazarus, is professor of law at Georgetown University and a graduate of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Professor Lazarus, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and staff there at The Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Also, the program is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information is available on their website, which is wardenmartin.subaru.com. And that's it for us here on Focus 580. We, of course, want you to stay tuned because coming up next, we'll have the afternoon magazine with the usual mix of news and sports and weather and features and another interview in the 1 o'clock hour. The host for the program, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, a glimpse into the world of science of the Victorian age. We'll hear about one of the biggest controversies of the 19th century, the origin of coral reefs. Our guest will be David Dobbs. He's the author of Reef Madness. That's at 1:06 Central Time this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 317. And that is... Dave Dickey, could you come here for a moment, please? We're having a little technical glitch here this morning, this afternoon. How do I read this number on the printout now? That's 317.
317 and a half.
And a half. Okay.
4 3/4.
4 3/4. So we're back to the old system here.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. March wheat, 317 and a half, up 4 3/4. May, 326 and a half, up 5 1/4. March corn, 208 1/4, up 2 1/2. May, 217, up 3 1/2. July corn, 224 3/4, up 4.